Accession number 19089, Real One.
Stephen Kennedy, Real One. Mr. Kennedy, can you tell me when and where you were born, please?
I was born in Dublin on the 14th of June, 1919.
What was your family background?
My family background was, my father was an inspector on the railway, and my mother was a housekeeper to her mother, who was a very important midwife at the time. She was the second registered midwife in Ireland. My mother looked after the home there and eventually inherited the home. My father died aged 33 from pneumonia, and after a number of years my mother married again. I had a sister and a brother and two sisters as stepsisters. When I became went to school until 14 years of age, and then got a job in the railway down at the docks in Dublin. I was an office messenger in the accounts department there, and all the ships from overseas used to dock there, and you could see the people all enjoying themselves, and they've talked about being all over the world, and immediately you want to get somewhere else in the world, and the only place you could do it was through the British forces. So I decided that I would go over and try and join the Navy, but the Navy were reluctant at the time to want you. They said I hadn't got the necessary eyesight for the Navy, but the recruiting sergeant at the Naval Office in Liverpool said, "Don't despair, go and see my friend, the sergeant, recruiting sergeant in the Army, if you're keen to join the services to go overseas." And he sent me up there to the main Scotland Road in Liverpool, and I was welcomed there, and they fixed me up. I said yes, I passed, my eyesight was A1 there, and I then, after 3 days in Liverpool, I was then sent to Bovington in Dorset, and there I did do the training, 9 months training at Bovington, and passed out, and eventually went to the 1st Royal Tank Regiment at Perham Down.
Can you tell me a little bit about the training that you had at Bovington? What did that involve?
The training at Bovington was basically, first of all, infantry training, drill, and then education was very important. They were trying to get people as well educated as possible. You had to have a second-class education to get on further in the army at the time. So we were all sitting for our second-class education certificate, which we passed. And then, after a while, we went onto MPV, Mechanical Propelled Vehicles training. And we had about 6 months of basic mechanical training on lorries, and we learned to drive, and I got my first driving license driving a 6-wheeler 3-tonner Morris Commercial. And then after 6 months we went to Lulwood.
How did you get along with the NCOs and officers during your training period?
The NCOs and officers in that time were really strict and had very, very little contact, personal contact, with other ranks, especially with the recruits. They were extremely good at their job, but the discipline was so strict that they had nothing to do with you at all in a personal sense. And the drill it was very, very strict, and we were on the parade for early morning, and we were in bed, half standby our beds at 9:30, and in bed, lights out at 10:15. No music, no radios, anything like that wasn't allowed. So it was really strict discipline.
And was there any, at that early stage, did you have any idea what role you would have?
Not really. All we wanted to do, when we were trained to do, is we would be part of a tank crew in one of the regiments. There were 6 Royal Tank Regiments at the time, and or battalions of the Royal Tank Corps, as it was called then. And we've been hoping then to get to Varian 1s. And I was posted then to the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, which was stationed at Perham Down, which is near Tidworth. And there we went on manoeuvres at Till's Head for a good part of the summer months. And we were under canvas all the time there. And then in the later part of August, they were then putting up lists for overseas service.
What tanks were you operating?
They were light tanks, Mark 6s.
Can you tell me something about them?
They they were a 3-man crew tank with Vickers machine guns, water cooled, and they had a Meadows Marine engine. That was the main 6-cylinder engine at the time that drove these. Front sprocket drive, and the tracks were extremely thin, and after every journey there was a number of broken pins, so half the time was spent repairing the track pins and the tanks and keeping them up to standard. And from that time, the Mark 6, we used to be out there on the Till's Head plain learning to drive, and we were then onto the ranges at Till's Head and at Tidworth, machine gun practice.
So you did all the roles in the tank
all
at that time?
All the crew, driving, the gunnery and the operator. There was the driver, the gunner and the operator. And the operator was usually the tank commander at the time. And then we...
Was it the intention that everybody would know how to operate all the various roles in the tank?
Yes, they did at that particular time. And
how do you drive a tank?
You sat in the driver's compartment, and you had 2 levers. You steered by levers. The normal gearbox, some tanks have pre-selector gearbox, but the normal gearbox in the centre between your legs, accelerator, clutch and brake, and you had a big handbrake as well, but your steering was controlled by levers. And it was just open front of you, the visor lifted up, and you looked out through the visor. And you didn't see much to the right or left, just ahead of you.
Did you have any communications in the
at that time, there was no internal communications, headphones like there were in later tanks. We just had to shout down to the driver. And they did sometimes have a voice tube. That was just a communication by a tube, metal tube, down into the driver's tank, and a large sort of opening for your mouth to fit into to give instructions in that way.
What form would the instructions take? Would you have a set list of things that you would say to a driver?
Driver advance, driver halt, driver right, driver left, speed up, slow down. That was all. It's only basic instructions.
And how would you turn the tank if you were driving it? How would you make it go to the left and the right?
Well, the actual... What had happened was that levers were forward like that, and when you wanted to go to the right, you pulled on this right-hand lever. Now, that stopped the right-hand track, and the left-hand track pulled it round to the right, and vice versa. This stopped this track, and the other one would turn it to the left. That's how it was steered.
And what form would your gunnery practice take?
The gunnery practice was, first of all, static targets, and then moving targets. They had a range, and they had this target on a rail, and it moved across. And as you can, you had to lay on the sights, so many segments in the sights for varying distances in front, and you got the range. The commander gave you the range of the target, and you then had to aim off if it was moving. You aim slightly in front. By the time the projectile, or the bullets that they were in those at that time, got to it, it would come. So you aimed off to the right, or in front of the actual target. And that was the sort of basic gunnery practice at that particular time. And after then, in the October time, and just in October and early November, we got leave, embarkation leave, and I was posted to the 6th Royal Tank Regiment in Egypt, and we had to go on embarkation leave then, and eventually we sailed from Southampton, calling at Gibraltar and Malta.
What did you, which ship did you sail on?
The SS Lancashire. So it's a very primitive troop ship. We slept in hammocks, and the hammocks had to be folded at Trevally and folded up and taken down and put away in the storage. And you sat at a table. There was big blank tables with six men, three on each side, and you stayed there most of the day until you were allowed to go up on deck. There was a canteen, but it didn't sell any alcohol. It was just sweets and chocolate and a bit of fruit. And the actual ship was divided into classes. There was the officers' part, which had all the main sort of deck, and they up behind the bridge and everything. One right side of the ship was for married families, and it was blocked off from the ordinary troops. And the married families were down, say, we say, the starboard side of the ship, right back to the stern. The troops were in the forward part, on the forecastle, as they call it, and they had a space there, just in the daylight, to just sit and lie about on the open hatch covers. And that's the way it went. First of all, you sailed through very bad weather down to Gibraltar. The weather became wonderful there. The ship refuelled at Gibraltar and sailed to Malta. In Malta, we stayed for a number of hours, and most unusual thing was that lined up beside us in Valletta Harbour were three Italian troop ships, which were probably the men that we were going to fight later in the years afterwards. And these Italian troop ships were there. There were civilian ships that had been used to carry, and you could see Italian soldiers were waving to us, and we were waving to them. And then we sailed down to Port Said, and we were disembarked at Port Said, and then we arrived by train in Cairo main station.
How long had the journey taken?
It took about a fortnight to get there, and it was quite all right, but it was very strictly disciplined, and you were glad to get off that ship, if you could understand what I mean.
What was your initial impressions of Egypt?
Oh, well, when you saw the people walking around, and everybody was, the men were wearing those red tar bushes at the time, and galabeas, and the ladies were all covered up with their veils and dressed completely in black. It was like going back a couple of centuries. And we arrived in the evening in Carlemaine Station, and the colonel of the regiment was there to welcome us. And we were then taken to main barracks, where it was absolutely wonderful. The food was excellent. We were being looked after by these native suffragis, and the regiment was first class, and we were in main barracks, and we had two squadrons at the time, B and C squadron. A squadron didn't exist at that time, and we got very good training. We got a trade. We had to sit for trades then, and I sat for a driver mechanic's trade, and I failed on welding. And then I decided I'd become a driver, a wireless operator. So I passed the wireless operation test and then the course and became a driver operator.
You were saying about a driver mechanics, taking the test for the driver mechanic. Apart from welding, what other aspects were there to the trade?
Tank driving, tank maintenance, all sorts of mechanical components you had to learn about, and you had to do all this fitting, drilling, everything to do with what is done by the Remy now, that sort of work. And it was a 6 months course, and there was a number of failures in it, and they eventually passed it on a second go. But nearly everybody in the regiment was a tradesman of some sort.
Well, you became a wireless operator.
I became a driver operator.
A driver operator. What did that entail? What did you have to learn about operating the wireless?
We learned all the basics of radio communications. Short wave, medium wave, long wave, and we all to do with everything worked off 6-volt batteries in those days, and we learned all battery maintenance, charging. As I told you before, the actual fitting of the wireless sets into the turrets of the tanks was quite a complicated business, and we learned how to do that as efficiently as we could.
Who would you be communicating with?
The regiment had two frequencies allotted to it by brigade headquarters. Ours were 3.5 megacycles per second and 3.7 megacycles per second. And you know they are shortwave frequencies. And the range of the sets were only about, between 3 and 5 miles at the time, speech. We learned a bit of Morse, but Morse would only be used at the last resort. And although we passed our 12 words a minute test, we weren't really kept at it. The Royal Signals, each regimental HQ had a platoon of signals people as well, and they did the long-range communication from the regiment back to brigade, back to division. And we simply did it from our squadron back to our regimental headquarters. And that was why those sets were used at that time. And we learned quite a bit about the electrical components of the sets, the variant valve changing and all that sort of thing.
And you mentioned your accommodation as being very good.
Well, the accommodation, the in Cairo there was the light section and the medium section in each company, as it was. They changed afterwards to squadrons, but in C Company, a medium section and light section. I was in the light section, and we had a very good large bedroom, a barrack room, which about, let me see, about 24 men, but it was vast and it was well spaced. Beds could be left down. Mosquito nets were on. Every bed had a mosquito net on it. And the suffragis used to bring us an early morning cup of tea just after Reveille. And then at 11 o'clock, they used to come round, chai, apple pie. And you could buy your tea and apple pie at the break time. The meals were excellent, and although we were used as ordinary troopers for potato peeling, most the cooking and everything was done by the Egyptian cooks and waiters, and it was first class, as I showed you in the photos there. The dining room was super, and the food was super.
You mentioned off the record that it was an old Turkish barracks?
Yes, it was a Turkish barracks. We had one side of it, and on the opposite side to us was the King's Royal Irish Hussars, the 8th Hussars. And being Irish myself, I used to love to hear the music, because their morning reveille was played by their band, and they play a series of Irish tunes and marches. And being a cavalry regiment, they were more ceremonial than us, and they provided quite a lot of the ceremony here around the place. And further up the road was the 7th Hussars. And that was main barracks. And it was a Turkish barracks. And the old Turkish guard room was still left intact on the main entrance.
You mentioned in the organisation of the regiment. Can you tell me a little bit more about how it was organised?
Yes. Well, there was regimental HQ. And then we had two companies, as I told you, B Company and C Company. And they had two sections of medium tanks, six medium tanks, and six light tanks.
And that was still the Mark B light tank?
We had some Mark II light tanks. They were smaller tanks. And they had a Rolls-Royce engine in them, but they only had one machine gun. And they were done away with after a while. And, of course, later on when the war started, the medium tanks, as I told you, they didn't go into battle. The Crusader tank came in, and the regiment was equipped with them, and with the Mark 6B light tank, and that was the formation when the Italians started, and the war, it hadn't broke out, but the Italians were threatening, and there was a number of fascist sort of organisation in Alexandria, and it looked as though they were threatening Egypt at the time, and we were on standby, and
so this was before the war?
Just before the war broke out.
Right.
And eventually, when the war started, we moved to Merzimetruf.
Before we do that, can you tell me about the time before the war started, when you were in Egypt? Did you do exercises?
We did. We down on the road from Cairo to Port Said, at kilo 15, there was ranges, and we used to go down from Cairo, down along the Suez Road, down to kilo 15 and 16, and that area That's where I showed you that photograph of it telling off by the CO. He didn't get it right. We were training with infantry there, and the tanks went too far ahead of the infantry. But that was the sort of training we were doing.
Can you tell me a little bit about the training with infantry? What you were supposed to do?
The King's Royal Rifle Corps, they were the infantry regiment in the same brigade as we were. And they, the tanks would lead them on to a ridge, and then the tanks would go hull down on the ridge and scour the area, and if there was enemy there, obviously engage them at fire. And then the infantry would take over and come up and dig themselves in on that ridge, and then we would draw from the tanks, would then come back, leaving the infantry in the late evening and then in the night time. And that was the sort of training that did with the infantry.
So tanks were used to take ground, and then the infantry was used to consolidate.
Yeah. And they and then in the morning time, just at dawn, which was 4 a.m. by the way in Egypt, we had to stand to, spread out into air formation, and go forward to let the Rifle Brigade or the KRRC, which were, they were equipped with 1500 weight little trucks. They withdrew then, and we stayed there on the ridge. That was the kind of training that we were going to use later in the war.
And who was the colonel at the time of your regiment?
Oh no, you've got me there just for a moment.
It doesn't matter.
I just can't think. I'll probably remember afterwards.
That's fine. So you were training just outside of Cairo?
Yes. Kilo 15 to 20. And I believe, if you remember later on, when the Israelis attacked and crossed the Suez Canal, I think they got that far to that area where we had done our training. And if you read in the newspapers and all, they'd crossed the Suez Canal and they were in that area on the Suez Road.
What kind of uniform and equipment did you have?
We really had no specialised equipment because it was terribly warm, and all we did was we had the overalls, just light overalls, but in an awful lot of cases they were just in their shorts and shirts. It wasn't until later that the variant forms of tank suits and overalls came into being.
And did you carry a sidearm?
We had a 3.8 pistol with a pouch of ammunition, pouch and holster with a 3.8 pistol.